Hey, this is Bill Hale, and you're listening to Focus on Metal.
Hey, Metalheads, this is Scott.
Richie.
And we are welcoming you to
Metal Month 2014.
It's once again November in the month of metal.
Yeah, and it's cold.
Yeah. And yeah, actually that came up with our guest this week. We have Bill Hale from Hawaii. And of course, Bill's been on the show a couple of times already. And that was one of the things Bill asked me was, you know, Has winter hit there yet? And when I was talking to him, it hadn't yet. But it's getting cold.
Yeah, it's getting cold. It's going to get colder.
Absolutely. But definitely that kind of weather like that means you can pack yourselves into a club and hot and sweaty metal show and you're not dying.
So, yeah, definitely. Yeah,
absolutely. So, you know, obviously this week our guest, Bill Hale, and he has his brand new book he's trying to get out, Thrash, the Global Metal Movement. And I think it's a real cool idea, a photo book about all the great old thrash stuff and all of that. So, you saw Bill's other last two books and they're pretty cool what he's
got. Yeah, they're excellent.
Yeah.
You think back to that time, no YouTube.
Yeah.
Not many videos. Do you remember the big deal when Metallica's Cliff Em All came out?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Wow, you can see Metallica live or something like
right.
that. So all you had were the photographers taking
right.
the pictures.
Yeah.
And it's great to see those old photographs.
Yeah. I mean, even people got excited, you know, with like Dime Vision, you know, again, it's that thing of somebody who's close to the band, you know, videoing and stuff like that. And yeah, that's what Bill's stuff is that kind of stuff. Yeah.
Yeah. I think, you know, as metal fans get older, we get nostalgic.
Yeah.
That, you know, they were the great years for thrash metal. It was like 83 to say 88, 89.
Right, yeah.
And then a lot of thrash metal fans then think that, you know, all the bigger bands kind of commercialized themselves a little bit. But back then in the 80s, they were kind of, their sound wasn't formed yet as such. It was still a lot of punk influences in it.
Sure.
I think the labels hadn't really got to them yet, and radio airplay wasn't huge for them.
Yeah.
Because radio is more the I hate the term, hair metal kind of stuff. They kind of shunned the thrash metal. And you had the likes of Bill right up next to the stage taking all these photographs. And some of the guys in the bands, of course, like Megadeth, Metallica, some of the members, of course, have died.
Yeah.
So, you know, that's all you have are photographs back from those days. There wasn't that much video footage shot.
Yeah. And definitely he's got, you know, some of his you know, give backs on the campaign are, you know, great classic photos that, you know, stuff of like, you know, Jeff and Carrie when they were young, things like, you know, photographs that nobody has.
Yes.
So it's really great stuff that you have that. And you're right. It is, you know, it is interesting when you talk about thrash and where it comes from and not having the internet, not having YouTube, all that stuff. And these bands, you know, it was this thing of some, you know, guys who knew some punk or these guys that knew a few, you know, New Album bands. And it's that, you know, that kind of that DIY part of the New Album and the energy of the punk and kind of stuck them together and stuff. And you did have bands that had these different sounds because everybody was, you know, the stuff wasn't readily available to hear everything. So
no.
You just kind of had this thing of, you know, one guy who knew these five bands, and this other guy that knew these two bands and that kind of thing. So it really was this really cool organic sound, as opposed to, you know, a lot of the mainstream metal bands where it was something where everybody was exposed to it. And it was a very uniform influence. So it lent more uniformity to that mainstream sound.
Yeah. And I think Bill as well, Bill had access to the bands.
Oh yeah.
Because the bands weren't mainstream.
Right.
So he would have been backstage with them. He probably would have been in the van with them. He would have had ample opportunity to take as many photographs as he wanted with them, because these photographs, they weren't going in Rolling Stone.
Right.
You know, the Kerrang might pick up some of them, but you weren't going to see these in the mainstream magazines.
Right. Yeah.
And you didn't have to go through five layers of bureaucracy.
right.
to get a pass, to get a photograph done. Bill was probably one of these guys that he'd get to know one band,
mm-hmm.
and all the bands knew each other at the time. Right. And, oh, yeah, that's Bill Hale. He's a great photographer, and can I shoot your show? And, oh, yeah, come on down, shoot whatever right. you want.
Well, it's also, we had that reputation, but it was also that working, you know, with Metal Rendezvous, and so that was kind of the, you know, considered to be a real kind of, you know, in with the Metal Guys kind of magazine. It wasn't some glossy Hit Parader type of thing.
Yeah.
So, you know, they knew him. They liked the magazine. You know, you go back to someone like John Stranansky having an editor for that magazine that still to this day knows his metal inside and out. I mean, the guy is an encyclopedia of metal.
Yeah, definitely.
And, you know, it's stunning, you know, that he can rattle off catalog numbers for albums off the top of his head. It's mind-blowing. So when you got people like that, then obviously bands are like, yeah, these guys, they're not doing something as flavor of the day. They're really into what they're doing. They're going to really represent us. And, you know, I think it pays off. But, you know, even with the stuff you saw in Metal Rendezvous, there's just so much other stuff that Bill took as well that a lot of people, you know, he's never put out there. So
Yeah. Well, when we had Mick Hudson on, Mick said that, you know, one of the problems he had with the photographers these days is that they just keep shooting lots of photographs.
Yeah.
I think Bill was probably more of the Mick Hudson school where he's looking for their photograph.
Yeah, and that's what he talks about that. He talks about, you know, the fact that it's film, that you had X number of exposures. Yeah,
exactly.
You had to really plan out what you were doing, and you didn't really know what you got until you got back to the mm-hmm. darkroom. And sometimes you were like, oh, crap, that didn't really come out the way I wanted it to. But you had really one shot to do it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
definitely.
Yeah, I think it's a great book. I think it's going to be amazing. So, you know, hope everybody enjoys our talk with Bill Hale as we kick off November Metal Month here on Focus on Metal. I think we'll start it off with Track of the Week. Ah, yes, Track of the Week time. And this week for Track of the Week, we have Massacre Records artist Hell Dorados, direct from Germany, had their first album out in 2012, and they are just releasing this week their second one, entitled Lessons in Decay. Overall, pretty good album, a lot of catchy stuff on there, a lot of different influences creeping in on these guys. Just overall, just a really good sounding album. They had engineer Sven Geiger, who was, he's on front of house for Scorpion, Saxon, Motorhead. I mean, you can't get a better resume than that for an engineer on the album. And he's really putting his, all of his experience to work with getting these guys a pretty killer sound. And also, of course, a lot of albums that come out of Germany, they have some pretty killer artwork. And this album is no exception. And, of course, the internationally renowned Timo Wirtz is the guy behind the artwork for this one. Killer, killer stuff. We go up to Massacre Records and check out the cover for this one. And while you're there, just buy it. So, as I said, lots of good styles kind of represented on this one. There's melodic kind of Scorpions-type memorable hooks. And there's some Y&T type of stuff. There's AC/DC influences. There's all kinds of stuff in here. But, of course, there's kind of a sub-element to this week's episode, that being thrash. And so I was listening through the album and trying to think of which track would go so well with this week's thrash bent. And one of the tracks, the minute I heard it, it really reminded me of the original Metallica demo tapes going around. You know, the old classic stuff, No Life Till Leather, Metal Militia, all of that early, early tape trading stuff. And that's the song Megalomaniac. So I thought that's the perfect track to play for Track of the Week. So from Hell Dorados, from their brand new one out on Massacre Records, entitled Lessons in Decay, this one is Megalomaniac.
Brainwashed like a piece of clay, they're following you day by day. Hey, Bill.
Hey.
How we doing, man? I haven't talked to you in ages.
It isn't that long. It's been 2 years, right?
It has. Yeah.
How you doing?
All right. I'm doing pretty good.
You sound good.
Yeah, it's all an illusion, you know.
Is the winter setting in yet, or is it still a nice fall?
Well, this is like the tease day where it was about 70 today, but it's supposed to go down to like 50 tomorrow. So, and then probably the 40s by the weekend. So, yeah. So you're living the good life in Hawaii compared to us. So,
it's all you know. I don't know what to say anymore. It's okay. It's
cool. All right. Well, I'll tell you, it's great to hook up with you again. And of course, you know, our big topic of the evening, of course, is this great third book you're trying to put together.
Yeah, what's it called? Because I always forget. Thrash Metal, The Global Movement.
The Global Metal Movement.
So, yeah. I'm having Tom Tarkus from Midwest Metal do my writing because Mr. Nalbadian is very busy with his Metal Evolution DVD series.
He is. He is... He's going crazy between him and Carl. They are absolutely going nuts doing stuff. And, of course, all their stuff starts rolling out, you know, in November. So, yeah, he's a busy boy.
Yeah, and so Tom actually wrote something for me in the Megadeth book, and we kind of stayed in touch. And I was talking to Bob, and I know he's really busy. And I said, do you mind if I contact, you know, Tom and do this and, you know, Bob gave me his blessings. And Todd came up with the title, or actually two working titles, and we chose that one. And he, you know, he's younger than we are. He's really hungry about it, and he's really good about what he does. And so I'm really happy to have him on the project, you know. Yeah. And then the big news today. Are you ready for the big news?
I'm ready.
I'll give you the scoop because it's already been there for me. I got an email from Tom Gabriel Fisher today.
Nice.
And he's going to write the foreword to the book.
Oh, that is awesome.
Yeah, I was thinking who would be the best. I mean, I have Caden doing something, Caden from Hyrax, and we've been old friends. Mm. And when I thought about this, you know, Caden came to mind, we talked a little bit, and I knew he would like the introduction because he's, you know. And then who would write the foreword? I wanted something in the European scene who has such a big history on the thrash metal movement, on metal anyway. I mean, and the you know, everybody was Motorhead and Diamondhead kind of thing, right? Mm. And then the next two bands were Venom and Hellhammer, you know, who had this most, I don't know, impact on everybody. And then Celtic Frost, the first two Celtic Frost albums were just mind-blowing, you know? Yeah. And I thought, you know, and Tom and I have a good rapport and stuff, and I thought he would be the great one to come from Europe and bring something to the book.
Yeah, that is awesome. And you know, it's kind of funny too, because when you watch your video for the project and you mention you know, all these different bands, and you only mention a couple of European bands, but the one that you mention is Celtic Frost. So it's pretty cool that you come around and you're having him do it. So that's cool.
Yeah, and he's on the tentative cover, but it's one of those things. We were a kindred spirit, and we hang out a couple times, and the first time we showed up, we wore the same T-shirt. It was kind of like out of the blue, and we hung out a little bit and stuff, and I got to photograph him a couple times in L.A. and stuff, and it's always been that good rapport. And, of course, the Tripticon stuff is just out there still. It's amazing. Mm. And, you know, I think he fits the project really well, and so I'm really happy that he's aboard and stuff. And then, like I said, Caden from Hyrax, I call Caden the crown prince of thrash metal because the guy doesn't stop. He's been, you know, kind of always there in the last, I guess, 10 years, right? He's been coming on strong. You know, he finally has a really good lineup and they tour all the time. So I'm really happy for Caden.
We'll be right back.
Oh, yeah. The guy is an absolute road dog. Every time you look, he is playing somewhere.
Yeah, and I think it's, you know, and he has a real loyal phone. After all the big four, big five, you know, he's next kind of thing. And he's always been doing, he always pushes the metal, always the old school and the new school and stuff. So it's kind of cool.
Yeah, and I think it fits, you know, that kind of theme you were putting across with the project too, about no big corporate America kind of stuff seeping in here. And those are definitely, you know, guys that have always, stuck to their guns, done it their way, and not really taken influence from anybody else and done it their way. So it really fits the whole theme of what you want to represent in the book.
Exactly. Yeah, people like you, you understand the stuff. I mean, and because MTV did a good job, and their editors were wonderful and stuff, and, you know, MTV 5 Viacom, and for promotion, I got one 15-cent commercial for 2 weeks on VH1 Classic at 10:30.
Yeah.
You know, if they really were serious about this the Mega project, they could have put it that same commercial everywhere on all the networks, you know, like at least 3 times a day or whatever, and I would have sold a lot more books. I'd have more faith in corporate America, but they didn't do what they should have done with my book. And so I thought, you know, I looked around, I talked to some people and stuff, and a lot of the agents and people on the East Coast, or the books are published, they don't understand our metal. They don't understand thrash metal. But all the fans that I talked to, I mean, I've had this conversation, when I was in L.A., I had this conversation a lot. The last Anthrax album, Worship Music, it's an amazing album. You know, Dark Roots from Testament, it's amazing. You know, everybody's playing these great albums out. They're best of the crew right now, you know. And I don't think corporate America understands what the thrash people are doing still. I mean, you know, the new Metallica album next year, the new Megadeth album next year, the new Slayer album next year. So thrash metal is, you know, and these guys are 50, right?
Right.
You know, and they're still, or they're better than they were in their 20s and 30s. And and the other comments you had a lot when I was in L.A. was like, where was Deep Purple in their 50s, or Natters in their 50s, or Cheap Trick they were at. But all the bands we worshipped and stuff as kids, they weren't doing anything in their 50s except for the Stones. I think they took the 50s off, though. But, you know, I mean, Metallica's still doing it. They're better than ever. Dave and, you know, Megadeth are just everybody down the line. You'd like Overkill and Creator and Voivod, those bands are still monsters, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, you got a whole bunch of younger bands that are coming in now, too, that there's like a whole new crop that really, really get it. You know, bands like Onslaught, you know, those guys, they just really have that whole element to them. So it's an amazing scene, and you're right. It's been largely ignored by, you know, the mainstream.
Yeah, I mean, you know, so that was the kind of rallying thing for me, or the binding point was no corporate America. So I was looking around, how can I get this funded? Because, you know, to do a book of this nature, I mean, it costs a lot of money. And that's, so I was looking at Kickstarter, Indiegogo. Indiegogo was more grassroots still than Kickstarter. Kickstarter was getting kind of corporate for me. And so that's why I chose this, and you had to do the research and stuff like that. And I thought, well, the better thing to do, right, is like, you know, it's going to cost a little bit more. I mean, when MTV or ECW did it, you know, it's like 1995, and then you get Amazon discounts like $13, $14. We're all, you know, we're all spoiled by that. To do a book yourself, it's going to cost me a lot of money. I mean, it's a lot of money to publish a photo book, and a real good quality photo book. So I thought, you know, let's put it up the flag, pull out a few salutes, how many people can get involved, and give them amazing incentives, you know. Right. And so I'm turning out, you know, limited postcards. There's a cool Metallica shop in 83. There's a great Exodus shot with Bailoff and Kurt Hammett, and an amazing Kerry King shot with Jeff. I mean, you know, those are like postcards. And then you've got my book before, so I give out those great laminates and bookmark and stuff. And I thought, let's go one step further and do a limited edition photograph, 8x10s and 11x14s, and just make it so, you know, give it back. I mean, it's a lot of money. I think just for the book alone, the pledge is $80.
Right.
But you get your name in the book, you know, the shipping's included, plus, you know, a postcard and a, you know, all the stuff to make it really worth it. It's wild.
Yeah, absolutely. And you do. I mean, it was, for me, I'm looking at it, and And I'm like, oh, geez, like just like the photo choices. I mean, obviously I have, you know, my favorite picture of Dave that you took. It's hanging up on the wall with all the rest of my memorabilia. And I'm just like, for me, it's a bonus that it's a great book and I could get another Bill Hale photo in the deal as well. It's to me, I'm like, that's a win-win. And it just was like really hard for me to choose because he really did have such great, you know, stuff that was out there. And anybody that's a real hardcore thrash fan, that's just the kind of stuff that you know, you should be living to get a hold of is some of those photos.
Yeah, and then, well, thanks for that, Scott. I mean, I know you've always been, you know, behind my stuff, which is really kind of cool. Thanks. But I wanted to make sure people understood that, you know, I want the book out, you know, and then give them something extra, something really cool. Hmm. And then on the very high end, I do have some gallery photographs from my Metallica show in London. And I have some very limited, so these are one-of-a-kind photographs. There's some 60 by 20s and two amazing 30 by 40s. And for $1,000, a lot of money. But you get the book plus all the stuff, plus this, you know, 30 by 40 photograph. And in London, those photographs were going, the 40 by 30s were going for $1,500. So you're getting an amazing deal on these two really amazing Metallica photographs. I think there's one of James, which is the very last photograph I took of James before they went to New York, and he's on stage. He's the cover of the Metallica book, but the black and white version.
Yeah.
And then I think the other one is it's from that same show, but it's Cliff Burton and Dave Mustaine and Hatfield all on stage, and so that's one of my favorite shots too. So, like you said, those photographs alone were going for $1,500 in London, and I'm giving them away for $1,000 plus the book. You know.
And you're right. I mean, some of those large format ones like that, I mean, if you go online and you look at some of those companies that deal in that stuff, and you're just getting, you know, something that's just been, you know, almost mass produced, and you're paying upwards of that kind of money. And here you're getting a one-off. Bill Hale was exhibited in a gallery and everything, and you're getting a book, and you're also getting the satisfaction of being, like the book says, part of this global metal movement. So it's, to me, it's a killer deal.
Thanks. Yeah, you know, and just for me, it's just getting this book out. But, you know, you're right, getting the whole community together, you know. And on top of that, I think it's going to be a print run of 500 copies. Mm-hmm. I think there'll be maybe 550, but I have to give some press and some, you know, giveaways to the people who wrote the book. But 500 copies open to the public. I think I am going to, like, probably number them or something super, super special. So, you know, it's like, you know, one of 500 of this book.
Yeah.
And so, just to make it people understand that I'm really serious about this book coming out and doing like whatever I can do to make sure everybody knows this is a special thing, you know.
Yeah, I definitely, and you know, for anybody, you know, who's listening and who hasn't really seen any of Bill's books, I mean, they're out there. I mean, you've got the great one you did with Metallica and you know, the awesome one with Megadeth, and just the photos in there, because I don't think some people don't realize that, you know, you were an insider with these bands. They trusted you. You weren't just this, you know, photographer that wandered in and did the first three songs and, you know, they said, get the heck out. But you know, you hung out with them. And so a lot of photos you have are stuff that were truly like friends hanging out. No one else has these kind of photos that you do.
Yeah. Cause as the story goes, if you guys had the Metallica book, when Lars got to California, we did some podcast. When Lars got to California, he actually, by mistake or whatever, met the next people in the metal movement. You know, there's Quintana, Melbadian, Blind Slago, my editor, John Stransky. He knew everybody at one time for some reason. He knew what was going to happen. And we knew Metallica before it started happening. So when they got to San Francisco, it was like, okay, hang out with us and stuff like that. So yeah, you're right. I was one of the guys there. I was, you know, one of the few people always hanging out.
We'll be right back.
And then on the other thing, too, is we always try to emulate our idols. So they're trying to be Diamond Head or Deep Purple or whatever. I was trying to be Baron Woman or Jim Marshall. And right. So it really worked out really good where I had my little vision, they were doing their little thing, and you know, it turned out really good.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, when you talk about early, you know, original thrash metal photographers, I mean, there's only three of them. You know, it's Harold O, it's Brian Liu, and you. Other than that, anyone else is people that just came after you guys and weren't, you know, and also were when that movement was big enough that it kind of got noticed. But you were the three guys that were really right in there, right at the beginning. And, you know, I think of anyone who's probably the most insider guy, it was probably you.
I had the magazine, you know, Stranansky and I, we had Metal Rendezvous. Everybody wanted to be in it. And once you have a relationship like that, knowing that we were a serious magazine, not just a fanzine. And so I had access to everybody just about. And so there's great shots of Creator's first trip and Creator, you know, posing backstage, and then great shots of Voivod on their first trip and stuff. And I think I'm the only one in the States to actually photograph Sabina from Holy Moses three or four times. And then just being on a magazine staff, I get the other bands that no one really knew about, like MX Machine, Holy Terror. You know, I was there for all those bands like that, you know, and just having that rapport, having a magazine, people wanted to be there. So,
yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Not taking anything from Harold. Hi, Harold.
Yeah, I think it's just an amazing, amazing idea to do this. And, you know, I've been psyched since the first time you'd mentioned about wanting to do it. And I think it's well overdue, and people, you know, definitely should go up to, you know, go up to Indiegogo, and, you know, you can probably search, you know, Bill Hale thrash, and it'll come up, and you can watch Bill's quick 5-minute little talk about it as well, and see all the stuff. But I mean, you're the real deal.
My very Bill Hale video. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, it'll, that's like five minutes and 35 seconds of Vimeo fame for you right there. So.
Yeah, and that's the other thing about doing something like this. You have to, I mean, all the 80s, I think I was interviewed once or twice.
Yeah.
And then, you know, I really did a good 90s just working with bands, but in the 2000s when the Metallica book came out, also that was the most interviewed rock photographer on the planet. And so I had to relearn how to speak, how to think of stuff. And then finally with this indie thing, you have to like get in front of the camera. So I put my camera on a tripod, print it on, got the stuff in my head, scripted out. I think I did 3 or 4 takes, and then that was it.
Yeah. Well, like you said, I mean, it's like kind of like a grassroots thing, and it isn't, there's nothing corporate about it. And I really like the way you put it in the whole scope of it too, that, I mean, that's what thrash was as well, is it wasn't corporate. It was doing it your own way and stuff. So it's, I mean, people should have a good appreciation for how this all fits together.
Yeah, that's the thing. You know, I was thinking about, you know, because with the first two books, I had to go through and explain certain things, especially the guys at ECW were amazing, but I had to explain every little detail to them about Metallica. Mm. You know, James is always in the front, Lars is always in the back, and they didn't understand that. And then even down to the point where Lars was wearing his blue denim jacket or vest, and I forgot the actual term I used, his blue heavy metal denim jacket, and they wanted to know what that meant. So I had to explain everything to them, and, you know, doing it myself, I don't have to explain anything to anybody. Yeah. I can put a photograph there, not the color scheme I want, whatever. It's, you know, I know what to do. It's my third book kind of thing. And with Tom, he knows what I'm talking about already. That really cool relationship we have, that buddy or friend or whatever. I mean, like, you know what I'm talking about. So, and some people like that do, and Tom gets it. It's really kind of cool.
Yeah. I mean, that is cool to find somebody, you know, like that, because I know, you know, you've always had people like Bob involved and stuff like that. For you to find some new person that's able to do this is actually just a really cool find for you.
Yeah, and that was the whole point after, I mean, getting Scott Earle in the Metallica book was great. I thought about it. I wanted somebody who actually was on stage, but who was respected by the Bay Area headbangers, but wasn't from the Bay Area. Mm-hmm. And that was a tough one, because I had Stranansky, who, you know, he was there from the beginning with Metallica, and so was Juan Quintana. Those two had to be there. I needed a third person, and Scott Earle, we've had a good relationship over the years, and he was just, bam, he was there. Yeah. You know, and he was on stage, he saw Cliff, they actually called him down to Seattle to actually audition for Cliff's spot and stuff, so, you know, he was cool. And then Tom was a great choice for the Megadeth book. And I have a young kid, I don't mention his name, but he writes in a San Diego college paper right now. And he's going to do something too on the looking back how this stuff influenced his generation.
Cool.
So that's really kind of cool. Yeah, because it has to be tied in. It's not just good old photographs. It's the community around how I took these photographs, how these people, you know, like having Caton talk about coming from LA and playing all the time. And Tom, I really want him to talk about how it was coming to San Francisco and playing the Bay Area, and, you know, and hearing about, because, you know, you'd have to hear about it in Europe and then getting to play over here, especially with that, the Voivod Running Wild tour. That was, you know, pretty cool.
Yeah.
You know, and so, and you know, and the other thing too, this may be my last photo book. I think it takes a lot out of you to do this stuff, and you know, this might be the last one. So,
yeah. Jeez, I don't know. I'm like, I was ready to dedicate like a whole shelf of my bookshelf to like Bill Hale photo book. So I'm gonna have.
Well, if I can find a different way of doing it that's not so me, time inclusive, then it might be cool.
Yeah.
But right now, my time is super limited, and. You know, and I can only focus on one or two things at a time. And this is like the priority right now, you know, going at myself. And since it's an Indiegogo, it's a campaign thing. I have to spend a lot of time on the computer going through Twitters and going through Tumblrs and going through Instagrams, which is cool because I get to reconnect with people I haven't talked to in years now again.
Yeah.
And just make sure, hey, here's the thing. Check it out. Reblog it, please. You know, I'm just repeating myself over and over again because it's one of those things. It's all or nothing kind of thing. Because if I don't get the X amount of dollars, then I don't get funded.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah.
Definitely. Yeah. And I know you've been tweeting like crazy and absolutely putting a lot of time in this. And I think some people, I think, do have this impression that people just put this up and they sit back and, you know, either it happens or it doesn't. But I can vouch for you that you are constantly tweeting and sending stuff out and really trying to let everybody know about this and putting just a ton of effort in doing this.
Well, thanks, guys. And thanks for always, you know, retweeting my tweets. You know, that's the whole thing I really wanted, you know, just people just mention it once or twice, you know, because there's tons of fans out there, and I still get every day, like, I didn't know you were going to talk the book, you know, it's like, and you know us, I mean, you know, we, Terry and I used to, like, every day reach out to fan groups just like that, and still there's a person today that I didn't know you were talking about. And so no matter what you do, there's always someone out there, which is fine. I mean, that's the whole challenge and the good thing about all this.
Yeah But it is, you're right, it is amazing that the people that, you know, I even talk about that, you know, those books to people, and they're like, really? And, you know, I show them and they're like, holy crap, I didn't know about this. And you know, the first thing I say is like, you keep saying you listen to my show and you don't know about the book, but you know, but you're right. It's a constant thing to get this out there, because just like, you know, MTV giving you squat for support with stuff. I mean, the same thing, you don't really have very much other press on the outside either helping you out. It's really kind of word of mouth through the community getting this kind of stuff out.
Yeah, just very grassroots. And yeah, I'm really thankful for you and Albania and, you know, Billy Bolt now. Billy in Oregon is just, he's crazy. I love the guy. He's crazy, but, you know, he's coming on strong too. But I always say, the podcast is, you guys are the fanzines of this generation. Mm-hmm. I mean, you guys out of love, you know, and you guys all full-time jobs. We all have to work extra hard, whatever you guys, but you guys are dedicated to it. So it's really cool. I really appreciate that.
Yeah. No, it's.
I remember how hard it was running a fanzine with Strednowski. I mean, it was, you know, we all had full time jobs. We were going to gigs, coming back, and back then with no computers. So I'm in the dark room for hours. He's typing away and kind of thing and getting it together, pasting it up, and Xeroxing it in my mom's, you know, office and stuff. And it's like.
Yeah.
And I know podcasting isn't that easier. I mean, you guys have a lot of work to do, and so you get edit and all that stuff and upload it. And, oh.
Yeah, it is with the social media and the websites and all that stuff. You're, you know, I think it does compare to, you know, what you guys were doing back in the day with zines as well. And it's, you know, that was a community driven type of a thing as well. So it's I think it's a pretty kind of apt comparison.
Yeah, and then you do it for the love, because we didn't make any money back then.
Yeah,
you know.
Yep.
So
and we're still not making any money now. So yeah,
hasn't changed. Yeah, you know. but at least you get, you do something you like and you're pushing something you really, really enjoy. Oh, yeah. So I know you do. I know you stand behind everything you put out there. So,
yeah, absolutely. No, I definitely do that. And, you know, that's why, you know, when I stuff like this, it's kind of a no brainer to be able to get behind it and let people know and just promote the hell out of it. Cause I know end of the day, it's going to be something great. And if you're a real hardcore thrash fan, I mean, this is the kind of thing that you will look at over and over again. And for some people, it's going to bring back a shitload of memories. For other people, it's going to show them stuff that a scene they were, you know, like here on the East Coast, we didn't see a lot of stuff that happened on the West Coast. And, you know, I look through, you know, your first two books, and I look through even, you know, the one that Harold and Brian put together. And it's just amazing to go back and see all this stuff. And, it's just something that's well worth getting.
Yeah, because you're right on so many levels. Especially the thing I like about Harold's book is it's from a fan perspective, really. I mean, there's nothing professional about the book except for Ian putting it together. But it's like they had a camera, they had one roll of film, they jumped around, did what they had to do, and that was it. And it's very fan-oriented, which is really kind of cool. I'm out there, I have to, like, and, you know, I had deadlines, and I know exactly what kind of photographs I want for a cover. When you're on a magazine staff, it's totally different. Right. I don't have that freedom of just, like, you know, getting drunk and click, click, click. I had to, you know, be very focused on what I needed to get. But that really now, in retrospect, when you put a book together, that really sells it home, because these are, you know, really professional photographs. They're not fan shots. I mean, you know, the bands were there. I was there. We worked together and stuff, and the whole camaraderie kind of thing. And they really were accepting what mode I wanted to put them in and stuff. And, you know, nowadays, which is, I mean, I don't mind too much, but everybody's so corporate in their image. And, you know, yeah, they're airbrushed, or even like Carrie King, this chains are perfect kind of thing and this and that, and they're all in studios. I do photo sessions today still. I would never put somebody in a studio. You know, it's going to be outside, you know, whatever the light conditions are. I'm going to make it look like it's supposed to look, not like glossed over revolver kind of thing.
Right. Yeah.
Not to mention revolver.
People got to remember is that this is film. I mean, people are so used to now having a cell phone, AKA camera, in their hands 24/7. And, you know, you see people go to shows and stuff and they're just firing off pictures, and, you know, people are uploading tons of stuff. But this is back at a time when they didn't let you bring cameras into gigs or, you know, anywhere else unless you were, you know, unless you had the photo pass, and it's all film. You weren't just whacking off like billions of shots. Film was expensive and developing was expensive. And, you know, it was back when it was an art.
And you're right, because you had 36 exposures to work with, and you had to budget your time, and you figured out what the songs were on the set list. You kind of had to know what the band's going to do kind of thing. And you wanted to time that film change, maybe just before a guitar solo or after a guitar solo or during a break. Because you really, you know, all of a sudden you don't want to change film in the middle of something epic. You had to, like, really plan it out kind of thing. It was really pretty intense.
yeah, absolutely. And like you said, I mean, you got X number of shots as well. And so you just can't keep firing. And you don't even know what you've got till you've actually gone back in the dark room and started developing some sheets.
Your prey is loaded properly, and then the exposures are, you know, done right and stuff. And I think I only messed up one or two rolls of film. And, of course, they were super important, but when I was a kid. But, you know, you're right, all that little tedious, you know, you have to make sure this happens and that happens. And, you know, and the other thing, too, is you couldn't go out drinking and partying, especially on the road with the band. I was in, you know, I had to make my own combinations, get to the gig, make sure my pass is there, you know, photograph the band, maybe have a beer, then get back to the hotel room, the next gig's ready to go kind of thing. It's like,
Yeah, I know.
But nowadays, last night I have a buddy in town, he lives here, and he's a really good guitar player coming up, and I'm like taking photographs and posting them on the internet instantaneously, you know?
Yeah.
So it's a totally different beast now.
It is. It is absolutely a totally, totally different beast. Hoping this is gonna, you know, everybody out there listening, you know, we'll head up, go up, like I said, go up to Indiegogo and, you know, look up, you know, search Bill Hale, Thrash. He's under the photography category and you'll see it, you know, Thrash Metal, the global metal movement. You know, the video's up there. We've got, you know, Bill's got all the list of all the different perks for different levels of donation and stuff. You know, read through them. There's some just incredible stuff that's out there. I urge everybody to go and do that and do what you can to support the project and get Bill's third book out.
Well, thank you, Scott.
Hey, no problem. It's good to talk to you again after so many years. I think it was like April 2012 or something like that is the last time I talked to you. So, yeah, it's been a while.
Yeah. We talk once in a while. You know, I think we texted each other
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Now you're a Twitter fiend. Yay.
It's funny though. It's been the same thing with Bob too. Is that you know, I hadn't talked to Bob for quite a while either. Mostly because he was busy with the movie and so we've talked a bit more recently. But yeah, it's the same thing. It was just like, you know, a gap of a couple of years. So yeah.
Yeah. Did you get the movie yet? The first one?
Yeah, I did. I got the. He sent me the screener and it's freaking awesome. I love it and I'm planning it's going to play here in Lowell in November, so I'm psyched for that. So I'm probably actually just going to go right in the theater and see it on the big screen as well. So, yeah.
Yeah, I got to go for both screenings in L.A. the first time he did it, the testers and stuff, and it was, like, amazing to have, like, Dodd Dockin and Carl Scavasso and Greg Leon and John Sutherland and everybody in that little movie theater, and it was kind of like, really, they're on the screen, they're right next to me kind of thing, you know, John from Armored Saint and everybody, it was like, the first time I saw it, it was like guerrilla warfare, because it was going so quick, so much information, and I knew about Snow,
yeah,
and a la carte, but everybody else was like, and I knew, and then all of a sudden, you put the pieces together, and then the second time I saw it, I was like, oh yeah, and then, I think unwittingly, there's three themes that go through the movie. I mean, I don't think they planned that. And one is like how Eddie Van Halen took everybody from everything else.
Yeah.
Because, you know, and Greg Leon talking about his Bonnie Barr, and then Chris Holmes talking about his Marshall Stacks and stuff. And like, yeah, Eddie. And the other one's like, all these guys in the 80s were in a bunch of bands in the 70s.
Yeah.
And that was like, and then, yeah. The one that still gets to me is Tommy Lee and Joey Vera. That's still the oddest combination ever to the token people, you know. And then when Joey drove him over to meet Nicky Six, it was like, really?
Yeah, I mean, there's great stuff in that film, and yeah, I enjoyed every minute of it. And even one of my daughters watched it with me. When it was all done, she was like, "Is it done? Isn't there more? There's got to be more." She, you know, she wanted more too. So it was pretty cool that she was really into it as well. But I think it was really well done.
Yeah, it's a big difference from the first half to the second half, and you know, Joe Floyd from Warrior filmed most of it. And still the guitar player, and you can tell, like, you know, you got really into it towards the second part of that. We had Gene Hoglan on, or Lizzie Borden on, and people like that. Towards the end, you got more comfortable, but it's epic. I mean, it's something that had to be told, and then he has two other ones, you know.
Yeah.
I'm really happy for Bob, because he's finally, you know, getting some, because he's like headbanger number two, kind of thing, you know, John Sutherland, then it's him, and he's been slaving around like everybody else for years and not getting much, you know, pay or whatever. And, you know, we do my book there, we give him some money out of it and stuff. And, you know, now it's like, yay, finally.
Yeah, definitely. And I would tell you, I was, you know, because Bob invited me to the screening too, and I had something else that had come up, a family commitment at the same time, and it was killing me that I couldn't make it out there to the screening, because I was like, and I knew it was going to be just like you just described, of all those other folks being in there as well, and you know, I was, you know, like, oh, that was going to be so surreal to be sitting there watching it. I was seriously bummed that I couldn't make it out for the screening, but I was really happy that Bob got me the screener, and it's a great flick, and I'm looking forward to just seeing it, you know, big screen.
And the biggest thing was Lars's underwear. People love that photograph. They're laughing. So.
Yeah, it was, you know, and I told Bob too. I complimented him that other people, they would have taken the corporate route and they would have made that movie like The Lars Show, with just kind of everybody else as ancillary characters. But he really made it to the people that really should be in the spotlight. And Lars is just kind of that ancillary character that was in there. And in the gist of that movie, he is just kind of an ancillary character commenting on what he saw. So, you know, only someone like Bob would have done it the right way.
Yeah, exactly. And I thought it was, you're right, it was placed on the right places. And for me, it connected all the dots in that time period. You know, I did know how important Chris Holmes was, because he ran as Marshall Stacks to Eddie Van Halen and to Greg Leon kind of thing. And Greg was the hot shot guitar player for a long time, you know. And then, you know, the guy from Autograph, Steve Plunkett,
yeah.
You know, the way he, you know, his band was like, you were the big band. And the whole thing about the Starwood, and then bringing Dave Menichetti in was brilliant, because I always, for the longest time, tell everybody, there's only one California band, it's Y&T.
Yeah.
They play anything, everybody who's anybody opened up for Y&T, Van Halen, Motley Crue, Metallica, Vicious Rumors, whatever, they all opened up for Y&T. And, you know, having Dave there, and especially when you're talking about the Starwoods, it was like, you know, that was really, really cool.
Yeah. No, it was. I'm real happy for Bob. He put a lot of work into it, and you know, it's come to fruition with that. And I'm hoping the same thing for you with this book as well. That you know, we can pull this all together and get it out into the world.
Yeah, well, you've helped a lot, man. So thanks a lot.
Hey, no problem. You know, anything I can do for you, you let me know. Like I said, I'll keep on promoting it for the whole entire duration of the campaign, you know. So I'm definitely in your corner.
Yeah, today was a big day having you know, Tom emailing you back and say he's totally stoked about it. And a little side note, he's like, I bought your Metallica book, man. I showed everybody. It's amazing. And it's like, wow, really?
Wow, that's cool. Well, I'll tell you, it's been great to talk to you again, Bill. I always love having you on the show. You know, anyone who's got, you know, the historical perspective of all of that stuff, it's definitely you. And, you know, you're always a great guest, always been a great friend. So I appreciate you coming on and letting us help you out. All right, man. Well, we'll let you go and continue on with your beautiful day in Hawaii. And I will hopefully talk to you again soon.
Yeah. Okay, that sounds good. All right, man. Thanks, all right, man.
See ya.
All right, so there's my great interview with the one and only Bill Hale. I always love having Bill on, and it was always a great time. And it's difficult because he's in Hawaii, I'm here in Boston. Time difference is not a happy thing, but we, you know, make it happen. So I hope you guys enjoy that. And again, you know, go to Indiegogo, search Bill Hale Thrash, and help fund the effort to get this book out into everybody's hands. So do it for Bill. Do it for Metal Month. So anyways, anything else going on in the world there, Richie?
Yeah, you got the new Slash record.
I did.
Okay, now, and of course, well, I'm not going to talk about the Slash record. I'm going to talk about why do people keep asking him, Duff McKagan, and Matt Sorum about Velvet Revolver? Aren't that band dead, honestly?
I think probably because they never really officially said it's dead.
Yeah, but if Slash is going great guns with Miles Kennedy in the band,
sure.
The albums are good, right?
Yeah.
Duff McKagan's got loaded, writes for the Seattle newspaper. Matt Sorum, drumming. I know he's an artist.
Mm-hmm.
I know he's big into pets and all. So you see his name is out there as well. Dave Kushner is, he plays with all these super groups that go on tour,
sure,
you know, and Slash has done it, and Matt Sorum's done it, and Duff McKagan's done it.
Yeah.
So they're all out there, and when they ask him about Velvet Revolvers, it's like, oh, we still haven't found a singer. I'm like, really? Who are you waiting for? Like Freddie Mercury to arise from the dead? Like, just come out and be honest and say, you're not going to get back with Velvet Revolver. I think, is there really a demand for them at this stage?
There must be if everyone keeps asking about them.
I know, but I just think it's dead in the water.
Oh, yeah, you know, there also could be some kind of contractual thing that, you know, do they owe another record and they don't want to deal with, you know, with the label right now if they say we're dead and the label's going, hey, you owe us an album or, you know, is this a delaying action for something like that? It could be something with some kind of legality with Weiland and what they can say or not say. I don't know.
I think they played a show there, I think, a couple of years back with Scott Weiland, and they don't get on with him anymore.
And they might be doing it as a deliberate thing that they like people to ask because it keeps the name out there. And if they decide that they fall into a singer somewhere, that they go, yeah, okay, you know, we're off and running again.
Yeah, I think the band is dead in the water, but I think with the way the music industry is now, they still want to keep that door slightly open.
Yeah,
because it could be a little payday.
Yeah.
But I honestly don't believe it's anywhere under band members' radar.
Yeah, I don't think, you know, at all. If people think that they're going to go back with Weiland, I don't think that's going to happen.
I don't know. I don't think they're going to get back together, period, as Velvet Revolver. I think it's dead. It would have been done well before now.
Yeah.
Like, when was that? What was their second record? Libertad, wasn't it? I think it's like 6 years old.
Yeah. And I don't think it's going to be. I think some people, too, are like, oh, well, you know, maybe they'll have Miles sing, but I mean, Miles is doing Altbridge.
No, but that's
Miles
dumb.
Miles is doing Slash's thing.
Yeah, that's why it's dumb.
And there's a dynamic that works with each one of those bands and the way they write. And, you know, I don't think they want that other dynamic that happens because, you know, Velvet Revolver is kind of a different writing dynamic that they've got. So I don't think it's that either. But I think it goes along with, you know, the other thing of, you know, the constant GNR reunion.
Yeah, that's the only thing I think people are interested in is Slash stuff and Matt playing with Axl Rose again. And I think there's more chance of that happening than Velvet Revolver happening,
I think,
personally.
I think it's just that's kind of an offshoot of that because they have seen recently, they've seen Duff play with Axl again.
Yeah.
You know, and those guys talk and all that stuff. So I think there is this great white hope that the original Appetite lineup is going to get back together again. And I think anything that concerns what those guys do after GNR is just constant fodder for reunion.
Yeah, I don't think that Guns N' Roses reunion is going to happen.
Yeah.
I think you look at Axl Rose, I think he's not going to let it happen.
Yeah, I think, too, that I think someone like Slash looks at that and goes, I'm not going down that road again because he has some prodigious output, you know, and he's
definitely
constantly doing stuff. And he's found a partner in Miles that is equally prodigious with getting stuff out. If anything, they're waiting on each other because they're so busy putting out other music.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that he likes that. I think that Duff likes where he's at and he can pick and choose what he wants to do and enjoy everything he decides to do. So why go back to that as well? I'm sure that Steven Adler would probably really welcome the chance to have it happen.
Well, of all the guys in the band, he's probably the one that, like, I'd say Slash isn't short of money.
Yeah.
Probably Duff probably isn't short of money either.
I mean, he's an investment guru.
Exactly.
I mean,
Steven Adler snorted half of Columbia, so he's had drug problems on and off since Guns N' Roses split up. Right. So,
and then, you know, Izzy's kind of MIA, but I don't think he'd want to go back into that at all.
Well,
if you read
the book, Duff's book and Slash's book, Izzy had to get out of there or he'd be dead.
Yeah.
So, why he'd want to come back is beyond me.
Yeah.
Into that circus. I don't think the Guns N' Roses thing is happening. And I'd say that I think now that Miles Kennedy is a far better singer than Axl Rose is. And he nails the Guns N' Roses stuff when Slash does it live. And
he does. But, you know, in respect to Axl, though, you know, at that time, I mean, that voice with that band was the perfect foil for everything else that was happening in music. It was hard, it was gritty, and I mean, Miles is one of my favorite vocalists out there. He's fantastic.
He is a great singer.
Does. To have somebody with that kind of a smoother voice with that band, it wouldn't have made the impact that band did. But Axl just has that anger in his voice, and I think it worked. It made everything work to make that band stand out at a time when it really needed to.
Yeah.
That, you know, his voice, his personality. When you heard that album, and I bought that album during that first wave when nobody gave it a second look. So there weren't videos out for it yet, you know? And when you actually saw the video finally, it was like, wow, that's the guy I expected to see from the voice I heard on the album.
Yeah.
I don't think it would have worked with anybody else but him.
No, definitely. Yeah, you're probably right. I bought Appetite when it came out too. When there were nobody, and the band cover of the painting on it and all that.
Oh, the alien. Yeah, yeah.
That's the one I've got.
Damn, I don't have that one.
Yeah, I don't have the one with the tattoo.
Yeah,
and I've got the the Live Like a Suicide on picture disc.
Yeah.
I think that was before the album came out. So I've got a couple of things at home that are worth a few dollars.
That's nice, yeah.
But yeah, when they came out, you're talking Poison, Cinderella.
Right.
Quiet Riot. And then I think Permanent Vacation, I think, came out the same year.
Uh-huh.
And then you had Appetite for Destruction and you had Faster Pussycat. And Kerrang were, the debate in Kerrang was that the writers were, which band is going to be bigger? Is it going to be Faster Pussycat or Guns N' Roses? And some of the writers thought Faster Pussycat were going to be bigger.
Yeah.
Because they both started from nothing. Uh-huh. They were both on major labels.
Right.
Faster Pussycat was on Elektra and Guns N' Roses were on Geffen.
Yeah, yeah.
And Guns N' Roses just happened to take off and Faster Pussycat didn't.
Right, yeah.
And that's, I think MTV had a big...
Oh yeah, it was Tom really getting that. Please play it once.
Yeah, was it Welcome to the Jungle?
Yeah,
wasn't it?
Yeah, it was I think that was a key to it. Was that because you're right? I mean, some of it sound wise was very similar. Each band playing live, it always sounded like it was going to fall apart at any time.
Mm-hmm.
And again, Tame Me Down does not have a smooth voice either.
Yeah, but I think what set Guns N' Roses apart from Faster Pussycat was Slash's guitar tone.
Yeah,
and the sound that he had, I think it just stood. And I know they had the image thing as well, but I think when you listen to Slash and you hear him playing, you know it's him.
Yeah,
and I think with the likes of Faster Pussycat, it's a little, you know, they didn't really have that same
Slash had that kind of a drivey, gritty sound.
Yeah,
but the other part that was there was interesting was that it was Slash doing that, but then you had, and it was almost unheard of at that period of time. You had Izzy playing hollow body Gibsons and hollow body Greshes. And so it was where everybody else was really two solid body guitars, usually two Les Pauls, or it was very matching guitar tones. When you look at Faster, a lot of times it was both those guys, you know, either a Les Paul and a Les Paul Junior or two Les Pauls, or but it was never like the classic thing like with Aerosmith. Part of their the thing of their sound is that usually if Joe's playing a Strat, then Brad's playing a Les Paul, or mm-hmm. vice versa. There's always a difference between what they're playing. So there's kind of a, you can tell the tones.
Yeah.
And, you know, same thing. Izzy was always playing something that was markedly different from what Slash was playing guitar-wise. But also, I mean, like I said, except for Ted Nugent, nobody was out there in hard rock metal type of scene playing a hollow body guitar.
Yeah, yeah. And I think as well.
And I take that back, Malcolm Young.
Malcolm Young. But I think a lot of that might have to do, I think, with Mike Clink producing it, because if you had another name producer, they might have looked at Izzy and said, you can't play that.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, that there's no way that tone is going to go on, you know, that sound is going to go on this record. You're never going to get played on the radio.
There's probably that, and I think the other part too was that they were a gang. And it was going to be like, nope, you're not fucking with that at all.
Yeah, true.
They would have closed ranks and were like, uh-uh.
True, true.
You know, because they trusted no one.
Yeah, and then of course the album blew up and they became a bit of a circus, and in the '90s, yeah, for the Use Your Illusion. But Velvet Revolver, dead in the water.
Yeah,
I'm afraid.
I kind of tend to agree with you. But the other part too is from a business perspective. I think they would look at that and go, "Is it really worth our while to do it? Like, what are we going to sell?" And we're not going to really probably tour because we're also busy doing other things.
Mm-hmm.
So why tour?
Now, I was over here before I moved here, and they were in the Comcast Center, Velvet Revolver, and they had Alice in Chains supporting them. I think that was about 2000, and it was the first album.
Yeah.
And I went to see Alice in Chains, then I went home. But they were able to, like, get the Comcast Center as a venue.
Yeah.
If they came back now, no way they're playing the Comcast Center.
Right. I mean, they at that point in time, they had, what, two singles off that first one? They were getting tons of radio. Well, heard them all the time.
Yeah, I can't remember the name of the first big song, Slither.
Slither, yeah. Yeah, yeah, and that was, you know, and it was a very different sounding song, and they were all over the place. You know?
Yeah, yeah, and the Comcast Center is like 20,000.
Yeah.
I'd say if they came back now to House of Blues.
Probably,
yeah. Because Slash's band now are House of Blues band. Yeah. They're House of Blues size band.
Yeah, and I don't really listen to commercial radio, but I don't think they're really playing anything from World on Fire on commercial radio.
No.
And there are some tracks that would slot right in there real nice, too.
Yeah, but they don't play them. It's like Michael Hannon said, Blue Oyster Cult have had three songs ever. You know, they're not playing any new music at all.
Yeah, yeah.
The only time a commercial radio station will play new music, and even then they mightn't do it, as if they're sponsoring the band's show.
Right.
Then they might play it, but they're not going to just pick it off the shelf and say, oh, let's play the new Slash song. You know, Eddie Trunk will play it, or some of the metal stations,
right,
maybe Sirius,
right.
But the commercial radio aren't going to play Slash's new album, which is a pity, because it's good stuff.
Right.
Yep. So, yeah, so that's it.
Awesome. And of course, you know, as we head into Metal Month, just a reminder that, of course, Bob Nalbandian's film Inside Metal is heading to theaters all over the U.S. And you can go up to metalrockfilms.com and all the dates are there. There's a lot of them. So
it's fantastic.
You can catch that at a theater near you. And of course, I know it's coming to our hometown. I think the 13th, I think it is. So I think the tentative plan is to go view that thing on the big screen. And
3 hours of metal on a big screen. What's wrong with that?
With a room full of other metalheads. So.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
That should be good.
I'm hoping that will go off. I know that the last time I attempted that experience was, it was that big four simulcast thing.
Well, you went to that, did you?
Yeah. Well, I went to it. Two of my daughters went to it. It was
Was that the first show?
It was a Father's Day gift.
Was that the first show that they simulcast, or was it just one of the first shows?
It was like the first one they were doing. Yeah, so we went, same theater Bob's is going, and some kind of thing, and whatever it is, someone didn't tell somebody something, and they ended up having to refund everybody's money.
Oh, for God's sake. And when you say everyone, how many were there?
It was that the theater was almost full.
Oh, for God's sake.
Yeah.
That's terrible.
Yeah, yeah. It was definitely a total letdown.
It was advertised,
Yeah.
Word got out there via Twitter, Facebook. They advertised it and you all went down and yeah. some intern forgot to turn on the switch or something. Oh, for God's sake.
Yeah, they were trying. A guy would keep coming in and being like, no, we're still trying to get it straightened out. And then, yeah, after about like 20 minutes or so, he was like, yeah, it's not happening.
Yeah, if that was fucking Katy Perry, she'd have the bloody switch on for it to be on.
But, yeah, so I'm hoping this time it won't be that. But that's the tentative plan right now is to go and see that thing on the massive big screen.
I'm hoping there's a good turnout. I really am. Because Bob... A lot of people have gone to a lot of effort. Bob, you know, Bob's been out there putting the word out. We've interviewed him.
Yeah.
He's been interviewed by a lot of different people. And the whole plan on this, you know, was to hopefully get it in the theaters. And it is in a lot of them. I'll hand it to Bob. I thought it would be in certain select cities.
I know. It's like, I think it's in like 4 theaters in Mass.
Yeah. Yeah. Which is fantastic. Yeah. I'm just hoping to get the turnout, because if they get the turnout in this thing, you know, hopefully takes off. He's got 2 more movies.
Right.
So if you see, this will be like the Lord of the Rings trilogy, you know, this will be the first one. And then next year you go see the second one, and then the following year, hopefully the other one, and see them all in a theater. It'll be fantastic.
Yeah.
And, Bob, you know, it's great for Bob, because Bob did a bang-up job of this. Yep. You know, it'd be fantastic to see it in cinema.
He absolutely did. So So definitely said head up to Metal Rock Films and check out all the dates. I'm sure there's one, if you're here in the States, coming near you. And I'm sure that Bob's pushing to get this out, you know, all over the place worldwide as well. So definitely do that. And again, head up to Indiegogo and look up Bill Hale's project as well and help him out with that as well. So I think that's a good start to Metal Month.
That's it.
We've got lots more good stuff on the way. You've been talking to people and we got some really cool stuff coming up.
More stuff coming up.
And I know that... hopefully tomorrow afternoon I'll be putting together an interview with a metal legend as well. So hopefully that actually happens since they're on the road. But sometimes when they're on the road, things get a little funky. But hoping for that. So, I think off to a good start with Metal Month. And keep up with us on FocusOnMetal.net, FocusOnMetal.blogspot.com, Twitter.com/FocusOnMetal. And, of course, if you want to shoot us an email, it's Richie@FocusOnMetal.net. Or Scott@FocusOnMetal.net. Until next week, Scott.
Richie.
Saying thanks for listening, thanks for the support, and until we talk to you again, remember,
Focus on Metal!
Everything else is insignificant.
Still here? It's over. Go home.